The last case on the court's oral calendar this morning is in the marriage of Brenda K. Blazek versus James Dennis Phineas, and I apologize if I've mispronounced anyone's name. Please let the court know when you provide your leg of the argument. We'll hear first from attorney for appellant. Please approach the podium. Name for the record, and then you may begin your argument. You'll have 15 minutes for your primary argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Katie Barrett-Wick, counsel for appellant James Phineas. May it please the court. What's mine is mine. What's yours is yours. These were the expectations that Jim Phineas and Brenda Blazek brought to their marriage about how to handle their assets. We know this because they codified this concept in their antenuptial agreement in numerous places. In the event of divorce, Ms. Blazek would be entitled to a $50,000 payment and several months of additional payments to stabilize her housing costs, which amounted to almost $10,000, in fact, and a red convertible. Beyond that, what was hers was hers. But when Ms. Blazek decided to end the marriage, she was no longer happy with the deal she had struck. She therefore made a number of secret deposits into jointly titled investment accounts to position herself to make a truly incredible argument based upon an erroneous interpretation of the agreement. She succeeded. The district court, reading the definition of joint property in isolation from other relevant provisions and the totality of the agreement as a whole, determined that Ms. Blazek was entitled to half the value of these disputed investment accounts, which totaled $1.7 million, and awarded a judgment to Ms. Blazek in that amount.
Ms. Wick, would it be fair to say that nowhere in the agreement is the word property defined to include, I don't want to go down that road. Nowhere in the agreement is the word property defined to mean real estate property? Would that be a fair statement?
I agree with that.
Okay.
In Exhibits A and B, where the non-marital property are itemized from both parties pre-marriage, the word property is only used relating to real property and personal property, and it isn't used as it relates to investment or bank accounts. The interpretation below, reading joint property in isolation, was legal error. The district court should be reversed and the judgment vacated and remand for entry of judgment for Ms. Blazek only in the small amounts under $3,000 that she contributed. How do we know the district court read 4.3 in isolation? We know this because there was only a small portion of the agreement discussed in the district court's order. The district court did not in any way acknowledge or analyze what we think is a very important framing provision where we know the parties intended what's mine and mine and what's yours is yours, and that's under Article 1, the circumstances and expectations. And there we see that the parties...
But, I mean, okay, fair enough. You know, I agree with you, Ms. Wick. It says what it says in circumstances and expectations. But would it... But where do we look to, as we learned from the last case, we all have our own expectations, and you can even put that in a document. But what matters is, you know, what the agreement and the covenants say. And I guess why wouldn't we look exclusively to, you know, the key two sentences that discusses joint property and then joint property includes? I mean, why isn't that sort of the key things we should be looking at?
I would agree with you. It is the key thing that the court should be looking at. It's just that in understanding what the plain language means, we have to look at the totality of the agreement. And that's where I think only supports our reading of the second clause of 4.3, which is that that is intended to be one of exclusion. So the joint property can only be created when there was an intentional action by the parties together, which just did not happen here with any of the investment accounts. And that is absolutely undisputed. Ms. Blazek admitted on cross-examination that Mr. Phineas did not know that she made these deposits. She knew that he did not know that. And I think it's particularly important to focus on the instance of the LPL account, which ended up having sort of the largest amount of his non-marital assets that were awarded to her, that was the instance where Mr. Fenice asked Ms. Blazek to put a $100,000 deposit of his own non-marital assets in, and she told him that she would do that, but she didn't. She put $99,000 of his and $1,000 of hers for the express purpose of making this argument under the agreement,
That's okay. So I understand your I mean, it seems like you have separate and independent reasons for arguing why this doesn't apply. One is that 4.3 must relate only to, I think, is it real only real property or also include personal property?
So
what's your argument on that?
My argument is it should be physical, sort of tangible property. It was framed as real property below in the small amount of argument that the district court allowed.
But that would not include your argument. Intangible to you means that it is a bank account,
right?
Or it's money.
That's right.
Cash money. Okay. So, and then your understanding of the agreement is, I think, that there would never be marital property created. Is that right?
Yes. The only exclusion to the mine is mine, yours is yours, is if they acted together to purchase something that totaled the value was in excess of $1,000 and they each contributed to it.
And on top of that, you're making another argument that they have to, like, sort of have a meeting of the minds or travel together or, so, I don't know, something.
Yeah.
But he knew when he was putting money in. I mean, is there any question that he knew he was not putting it in his own account, but he was putting in a joint account?
I agree that he knew he was putting it in a joint account.
What else could one think? I mean, he didn't have to put his non-marital property in a joint account.
Right.
And so if he's putting in a joint account, and we know that joint accounts are split equally, is the argument that, well, he understood that, let's pretend for a moment it's not real property, I'm not sure what we think his understanding of it is, but that if he put it in there, as long as she had nothing in there and it's called a joint account, she doesn't get anything? I'm not exactly sure, like, why you would put it in a joint account except thinking, hey, this is a joint account.
Okay. There's a lot there, and I want to try to address all of it. No, so first of all, you said something to the effect of, we know if it's joint property, it's split equally. I think it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about the ownership of the assets in a jointly titled account under Minnesota law, that's not the case. We know from the Minnesota Multi-Party Act that while there may be legal rights to each party to take action under a joint account, during the party's lives, so a creditor,
under the agreement.
Okay, right.
Not the law, because the question is what this agreement provided, right? Not what
Understood.
The law applies to joint accounts. Yeah.
Right. So then I would draw your attention. I mean, the understanding. So the language itself says that joint property has to be purchased by the parties together, and it has to be cost in excess of $1,000. So I think the expectation was, and there is not a lot of evidence in the record about what the party's intent was when opening joint accounts. Mr. Fenice testified that he thought he needed to do that in order for her to inherit if he died. So in order for the accounts to go to her if he passed away, I frame that in the brief as incorrect because he could have had a beneficiary designation, and they were working with Ms. Blazek's brother as an investment advisor, and so I don't think there's a lot of information about why he had that misunderstanding, and I do think that's a concern. But there is no evidence to suggest that the parties intended to create joint property as defined by the agreement when they simply titled the accounts jointly. And I will point out that Ms. Blazek never, many times in the record, at the hearing, she herself didn't understand that to have been sufficient. She said on pages 35, 36, and 48, she used the phrase truly joint. Well, I knew I had to put in my own non-marital assets to make the accounts truly joint. And she was asked about this several different of the small deposits. And she did not understand that simply jointly titling the property was sufficient.
So apparently, I want to make sure I phrase this very carefully. It sounds like both sides may have not had the best of legal representation as it relates to both the agreement and the kind of pre-dissolution lawyering up.
Yes.
Okay. You know, when I read the district court's order and the agreement and your brief, the first thing I thought was, this all could have been solved if the word joint property had the word, and I think Ms. Counsel for the respondent points this out, joint property only includes, I mean, and it doesn't. Yeah. So, yeah. So how do you win then? I mean, I get it. And, you know, I don't particularly like the whole sort of putting money that he didn't know about, you know, when it was clear she was going to leave. I mean, you know, and obviously the district court didn't like it either because there were specific credibility determinations. But, you know, once again, you know, I don't know how we can, if we believe that this paragraph, these two sentences, are kind of the key as it relates to how this money is being divided, how do we get around that when it seems to me it could have easily been solved by drafting it differently?
So my understanding of what the district court did with that sentence is treat it as an example. And why I think that is legally incorrect when you read 4.3 in light of the document as a whole is that it doesn't make sense to provide such a specific multi-factor sort of circumstance as an example. If it was sufficient to have the accounts jointly titled, 4.3 could have ended after the first sentence. Period. So I think my strongest argument on that is that second sentence has to mean something. It is such a strangely specific example. Judge Larkin, did you?
Oh, we finished. And
it's such a strangely specific example that, and it doesn't include any of the other types of clauses that we see, for instance, in the Peterson case, you know, where there's lots of different things listed. And it makes sense in light of the intention of the mine is mine, yours and yours, for there to require this intentional action to buy something fairly valuable together using the non-marital assets from each in order to pull the parties out of the default under the agreement of what's mine and mine, what is yours is yours. Judge Larkin.
Following up on Judge Connolly's question, I mean, I'm having some difficulty with the fact that it is a separate sentence. It seems to me that you're reading that second sentence as the definition of joint property. But as that paragraph is written, we have the first sentence which says joint property means blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So there's your definition. And now we have it includes, which seems to be an example. I mean, instead of inserting the word only, if you took out the word joint property includes property and we just went from tenants in common or otherwise and which costs in excess of, so you could make that kind of description part of the definition, but it seems to me that that description is set off by language that tells us that's not the definition, that's an example. I mean, just the way it's structured leads to that conclusion.
So I would suggest that the better reading is that joint property, the first sentence is necessary but not sufficient, so it has to be jointly titled, and then the second sentence it requires the joint action and all the, you know, sort of the...
But then what you would be saying is, I mean, you're making that a requirement, and there's nothing in the language that makes it a requirement. If it said joint property only includes property which, or joint property must cost in excess of blah, 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 there are simple words which would indicate that that second sentence is part of the definition as you're arguing, but none of those words are here. You're asking us to read something else in, it seems. I mean, is it ambiguous such that we should be reading something into it or looking elsewhere to figure out what it means, or does it just clearly say what it says?
Well, I think it clearly says what it says, but as a way of, it is part of the definition section of joint property. So I think the best reading of it, particularly in light of the document as a whole and what the parties intended, is what I had stated, that joint property has to be jointly titled, but then in order for it to be joint, so that's not enough. In order for it to be joint, it has to meet the definition of the second sentence.
What
and
if,
that, I think, requires joint action together and knowledge and intentionality from both, and we just don't have that here.
What if it's something else entirely? I mean, I think property would normally include bank accounts when we're talking family law, right? Okay. So if the first sentence, joint property means property that's titled in names of both parties, so it's just property, including bank accounts, let's say, or investment accounts, title and names of both property, that is. Secondly, joint property includes property which costs in excess of $1,000 that's purchased by both parties together during the marriage. What if that's a totally separate thing and it relates to, I don't know, they buy something together for more than $1,000? So it doesn't talk about titling. You know, if they buy a $900 car, well, we don't care about that. But if they buy a $1,000 car together using their property where they do it together, regardless of who it's titled with, that also is joint property. Maybe costing and purchasing is intentionally a different thing from titling in the first one.
So I think if that were the case, I think we would see also includes, and that would suggest that the first sentence in and of itself was sufficient to meet the definition of joint property and that there would be another way of creating it.
Right, exactly.
And I don't think, I mean, we don't have also there.
So we don't have only and we don't have also.
We don't have only, we don't have also. You know, we have an agreement and an itemization of non-marital assets with, you know, huge detail suggesting that the parties intended to preserve what they came into the marriage with. And that is the fair and best reading of this agreement, and we think that the best result for the court to reach is to reverse entirely, vacate the judgment, and remand.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Hear from counsel for
and on rebuttal, I would like to talk about the 5118.58 issue too. So just be prepared, that's coming. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record before you begin, please?
Yes, may please the court, Jennifer Nixon here representing Ms. Brenda Blazek. And the district court order here finding that the joint accounts are joint property pursuant to the antenuptial and awarding Ms. Blazek judgment for one half the value of those accounts was correctly decided and therefore should be affirmed in its entirety. The district court's interpretation of joint property is proper and is supported by the plain language of the antenuptial. Because neither party argues that the antenuptial is ambiguous here, I'm going to focus on how we would interpret an unambiguous contract. So unambiguous contracts are analyzed to determine the intent of the parties as seen in the four corners of the instrument and in reviewing terms according to their plain, ordinary, and popular meaning. And review of the entire contract is necessary, harmonizing all clauses to avoid an interpretation which would render any clause meaningless.
Is it your position that your client had to contribute to make this joint property?
It is my position that my client had to contribute her own non-marital funds in order to divide that equally as joint property.
And yes. And why is that consistent with your argument that the first sentence essentially ends the inquiry here? Why does she need to contribute?
Because looking at the contract as a whole, we would look to both section 6.1.2 and 6.1.3, which actually inform that definition. So 6.1.2 specifically refers to that joint property would be deemed one half non-marital property of each party. And 6.1.3 says any assets acquired during the marriage from both parties' non-marital property will be divided equally between the parties. So I think harmonizing both the 6.1.3 and 4.3, it's clear that the party's intent was all assets, and it's clear that the party's intent was that both of them would have needed to contribute non-marital property in order for it to be divided equally.
And my second question, why wouldn't the second sentence be mere surplusage and read out of it? I mean, what if they contributed $900? You know, if they did something that was a total of $900. I mean, what a weird example to give. Like, it's very specific. But sure. If it also includes $800, $700, $500, like, why would there be such an example as that?
Sure, and I think, again, reviewing the whole contract, you can see, given the facts of this case that are specific to the antenuptial and that are listed here in the antenuptial, that example would be needed. So looking at exhibits A and B, the exhibits show the extent and the nature of Mr. Fenice's assets. So for example, he testified that buying classic cars, as you can see from the exhibit, was a lifelong hobby of his. So, for example, if the parties were to purchase a $500 car that Mr. Fenice intended to restore, both of them contributed their non-marital assets. If that was not $1,000, so in this example, if it was a $500 car, the parties specifically intended that that would not be something that would be considered not joint property to be divided between the parties.
So you read those as like a floor for what it has to be. So even if that $500 car were titled in both parties, were jointly titled, it wouldn't be joint property because that second sentence like puts some parameters around it.
Right.
It's not just an example. It does place parameters around all joint property.
I believe that it places parameters around joint property that is purchased from both parties' non-marital assets. I don't think that it places parameters and requires that that must occur in order for it to be joint property divided between the parties.
So just to be clear, if they opened a bank account that's a joint bank account, like one of these accounts, and put in $900, that would be joint property under sentence one, and it would remain joint property that should be equally divided regardless of their respective contributions or not.
Right.
Okay, but if they buy a car for $900 and jointly title it, no, that doesn't fit a joint property definition because it wasn't purchased for $1,000.
Right, yes. I think that is consistent with the language of the antenuptial here.
Okay.
And I think that's, and the language of the antenuptial as a whole. So again, looking at 6.1.3, that refers to all assets, which would imply that definition of joint property was not intended to be limited to only that which is purchased and not intended to be limited to only tangible property, as Mr. Fenice argues. So yes, in that example, if they each contributed $400 to a $900 bank account, that would be considered joint property. And then under 6.1.3, it would be divided equally. And I want to...
Did your client, Ms. Dixon, have to, under the terms of this language, both sentences, in order to make this joint property, did she have to contribute those small amounts to all of these accounts in order for this language to apply?
In order for it to be divided equally, yes. She would have needed to contribute her own non-marital funds, even a small amount, because the antenuptial also provides regardless of their respective financial contributions. So the antenuptial, the plain language of it, does indicate that she would have needed to contribute something.
So I see. So you don't... So these accounts would fit under sentence one. Not sentence two, because they're not purchases of something, right?
Right.
So they fit under sentence one. So your belief that the antenuptial agreement required a contribution doesn't relate to sentence two. It relates to those section six things when it says a contribution presumes some contribution, not a contribution of zero. Since it equally divides based on contributions, it's presuming a contribution has to be made, and that's why she thinks, yeah, I must make a contribution. Is that right? Right? Okay. So you're living under sentence one and then section six, and then sentence two doesn't matter because that's dealing with things like cars or something.
Sentence two, I believe, wouldn't matter in this case. So as
exactly.
Applied to the facts here, yes.
Because these are bank accounts, essentially, or investment accounts, or dollar, they're money.
Right, yes.
Gotcha.
Can I follow up on that? I'm not understanding. If you're saying, okay, sentence one stands alone, applies to accounts that are jointly titled, why is it then that fact alone is not enough to get a finding that it's marital property to be divided equally?
Well, I think that it first of all, it wouldn't be considered marital property. The party specifically defined joint property.
Joint property.
And so they set out a different definition. And I think that 6.1.3 is what requires that they each contribute their non-marital funds. So I think that the contract as a whole needs to be read together. And so those sections need to be analyzed together and need to be harmonized, as the case law requires, in order to get to the district court's judgment. And I believe that the district court did that here. So the district court first looked at what does this definition mean? And then in that section where the district court is analyzing that, it also looked to 6.1.3. So consistent with the argument that I'm making here. It looked to both of those sections, harmonized both of those sections together.
I wonder, though, there's section 6.1.2, which says regardless of their respective financial contribution to its acquisition. So if it's regardless of their respective financial contributions, what if there's no financial contribution? Doesn't that suggest that as long as her name was on it, it's deemed to be one half non-marital property of each party?
I think that still doesn't harmonize that 6.1.3 with it. And so I think we need to look at that as well, which says that both parties need to contribute that non-marital asset in order for it to be divided equally.
The assets acquired during a marriage from both parties' non-marital property. So that's why you would think, yeah, we should. I mean, right. I guess we could conceivably decide it doesn't matter in this case. In another case, like the zero versus some isn't really what the issue is here exactly. But that's where you get that, I think, right? Is that it says, this applies to joint property, all assets acquired during the marriage from both parties' non-marital property. So she believes she should contribute some non-marital property, and then it's divided equally.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yes. Yes.
Which she did.
She did.
Yes, she did here. And because I know that you wanted to hear about the fiduciary duty examples, I'm happy to move on to that as well. Ms. Blazek did not violate her fiduciary duties here. So first, I would note that not the statutory argument, not referring to 518.58, that argument was actually not raised in the lower court, and so that should not be considered. However, even if it's considered, it does
fail. In the interest of justice.
Right. In the interest of justice, the court certainly could consider
it. So would it be fair to say your point on that, Ms. Nixon, is it says lots of things, but it doesn't say deposit? As in transferred, encumbered, concealed, or disposed of.
Oh, as to that statute, yes. Yes, exactly.
I would agree.
That would exactly be the point. Also, it doesn't say, the parties are arguing about joint property, not marital property, and the statute specifically refers to marital property. And so for both the reason that you stated and also that the statute does not refer to marital property, I would say that under that statute, Ms. Blazek did not breach her fiduciary duty. And also, there's nothing in the contract itself that specifically says that the parties need to that Ms. Blazek needed to inform Mr. Fenneis of making deposits into an account into her own name. This is something that
what are we to do with Ms. Wick's point about the whole, you know, I told you to put in 100,000 and it was 99 versus 1,000. That seems to be, well, I mean, it doesn't seem to be something that we would like up here. I guess I would refer to that as a bad fact for your client. So how do you get around that bad fact?
So I did review the transcript pretty carefully on this fact, and it's not clear that Mr. Fenneis actually directed Ms. Blazek to contribute $100,000 from his account specifically. So only that she was directed to deposit the funds. So she did that. She deposited $100,000 into the account. So both Mr. Fenneis testified that he understood that she would deposit $100,000 from his account, but not that he instructed her to. Ms. Blazek testified similarly, stating that she was instructed to deposit $100,000 into the account, but she didn't testify that she was instructed to deposit the funds from Mr. Fenneis's account. Now, of course, this might be splitting hairs, but this does undercut Mr. Fenneis's argument that Ms. Blazek acted especially deceitfully in making this deposit. And again, this was an account in her name. She could make deposits to an account in her name without Mr. Fenneis's consent, without Mr. Fenneis's knowledge at any time.
Is there some reason that she couldn't just put in his $100,000 and throw in $1,000 on top, make it a $101,000 account? Is there some upper limit that required it to be, or is that being sneaky so that it looked to him like it was only $100,000?
So there's nothing in the evidence that suggests that needed to be limited to $100,000. She could have deposited, $1,000 at a different time. Sure. That, as far as we can tell from the evidence, that would be the case. But Mr. Fenneis could have reviewed the statements at any time. This was an account in both parties' names. Both parties testified that Mr. Fenneis also had access to the statements, to the activity, and they did review some summary information.
But, I mean, is that really, I mean, this is, this is all post-heart attack, right? All these deposits.
Right.
And, you know, it seems like the record would indicate that, you know, he was relying on your client to kind of do the ordinary kind of money management related to these businesses and these accounts, correct?
Right, and I'd point out...
So the fact that well, you know, he could have read them so tough. I mean, under these circumstances, it sounds like he was trusting your client to kind of handle all this. So, I mean, is that the fact that... I mean, I'm not so sure I agree with you, Ms. Nixon, that, well, he could have read them if he wanted to, that under these circumstances, that was a likely expectation of the events.
And I'd point out a couple of things in response to that. As to his health, there's no evidence that his health actually impacted anything related to his finances through their marriage. His assets actually increased while the parties were married.
You know, that the stock market went up. And I mean, but my point is she was kind of in charge of the day-to-day moving of funds, and he was relying on her to do that. I mean, is that not what was really happening here?
That is what was really happening. Okay. I mean, she was in charge of managing the accounts on a daily basis, but this was at Mr. Fennice's direction. So they reviewed the accounts on a monthly basis.
Right, because she had the cheat sheet or something.
Yep, they called it a cheat sheet. They reviewed,
right.
You know, in summary, some information
about
their accounts.
So it really wasn't a cheat sheet from your perspective, because your client wasn't cheating him.
Well, sure, that's correct. I believe that Ms. Blazek referred to it as a cheat sheet, so
no, I get
I think
it.
Both parties did.
This is kind of the key document I look at to see what's going on. And was this like a monthly review, a weekly review? Or?
This, my understanding is that this was a monthly review.
Okay.
That is what appears in the evidence. And the parties only reviewed a summary of those accounts at Mr. Fennice's direction. So this was something that Mr. Fennice set up. He said, I only want a summary of these accounts. I want to know kind of what's going on in general. And so to say that now that, yes, I could have reviewed all of these statements, but I chose not to. I don't think that creates a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of my client, because Mr. Fennice kind of created this circumstance. And I see a red light. I believe that my time is up.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Connolly, you had indicated you wanted to speak about the statutory breach of fiduciary.
Yes, I mean, I mean, it doesn't say deposit. It says lots of things, but I'm not so sure how this helps you. So why am I wrong?
It is a stretch argument under the plain language of the statute. I agree. There were no counterclaims raised, and that's why I do want to be precise. You know, there has not yet been any breach of, you know, common law fiduciary duty. So faced with the brief post-trial argument that was allowed and some of the bad facts that came out at trial, trial counsel for Mr. Fennice, I think, did what she could to try to make those bad facts relevant. And, you know, it is substantively what the fiduciary duty statute prohibits, but sort of in the reverse in these unique situations. Judge Larkin, you raised, I think you were the only conversant in the opening argument that raised this question of ambiguity. I don't think that's the best way for the court to resolve this. The best way is what we have argued. Our request is that you read the language of 4.3 the way that we have suggested, because it makes the most sense in light of the agreement as a whole. I did want to raise, though, the possibility if the court determines that, you know, the parties below saying it means this unambiguously, determines that there would be an ambiguity. It is important in that instance that we would ask the court give some precision to the scope of the remand and the intent of the remand, or excuse me, the work that should be done on remand, which would be instructions to reopen the record and allow further discovery. And that would be because there would be a need to discover and ultimately admit extrinsic evidence of the party's intent and also their course of conduct and whether those actions were consistent with the covenant of good faith and fair dealing that was present in the antenuptial and any contract.
But it would be fair to say, Ms. Wick, that both parties argued below that the agreement was unambiguous.
That was their leading argument, but Mr. Fennice's trial counsel preserved an alternative argument at the very bottom of the...
I did see that.
Yeah, so there was a brief assertion of a ambiguity.
Because I'm assuming, without any expectations, that based on the trial counsel thought things are going south, better do something else.
Yeah, I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that's right.
Well, then good for her.
There was some discussion in my colleague's conversation with you about 6.1.3.1, and I think that the court and counsel is correct that in order for the, if you look at the 6.1.3, it says joint property that must be divided, it has to have been acquired by both parties' non-marital property. So simply, you know, the argument that the joint property, which apparently was the district court's sort of holding, was that the joint title was sufficient, that's not, that cannot be comported with how, you know, the 6.1.3. But just returning to where I started, the parties clearly intended what's mine and mine is what yours is yours. And they created a narrow exception of very specific conditions that must be met in order to you know, be an exception to that. And that is that the parties had to act intentionally by purchasing something that cost in excess of $1,000 together. And there was no together here. The only thing that happened was the joint titling, and at the time, the funding of those accounts with non-marital assets from Mr. Fenice alone. Mr. Fenice indicated he thought that was necessary for Ms. Blazek to be able to inherit those accounts if he died. His health, as we know, was you know, grave and still is, and there was no contemplation that that would enlarge her rights under the agreement in the event of dissolution. And so in this instance, the court should reverse. Was there a question?
So under your interpretation, if they bought, you know, 100 things at $900 each, it would not be joint property, even if they did it together, et cetera.
Correct.
It wouldn't be joint property, and instead, the Section 6 provisions wouldn't apply, and they would have to go back and figure out what their individual contributions were.
That's correct.
To each of those purchases.
Correct, because okay. 6.1.3 is how you divide things that meet the definition of 4.3. Correct.
All right, see, no further questions? No. Well, thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. That concludes the court's oral arguments this morning. We will now move on to our non-oral calendar. Thank you.
It was nice to see you again, Ms. Wick.
All right.
And you too, Mr. Reed.